You're listening to UNICEF Radio. I'm Blue Chevigny. Yasani Jose is a young man who recently got hired at a radio station in Zambia where he lives.
My name is Yasani Jose. I live in Lusaka, Zambia, and I am 21 years. I was born in 1986, and currently I'm working as an announcer for the University of Zambia's radio station.
Yasani's only been working at the radio station for a month and a half. Before that, he was working in music production, trying to break into radio. He produced the winning feature for the 2006 UNICEF One World Radio Contest, Living with HIV. When he presented the letter announcing he had made first prize at the university radio station, they decided to hire him for an open position.
Because of you guys there at UNICEF, I got a job.
The theme of the contest for 2006 was Unite for Children, Unite Against AIDS. Yasani was thrilled when he learned this was the theme, one that he had thought a lot about, and he had an easy time coming up with a feature to suit it.
All around the world, we've got people that complain about maybe in other countries there's famine, in other countries there's war, in other countries there's storms, you know. But in Africa, the most prominent thing that people talk about is HIV and AIDS, because it's affecting each and every person. Every age knows about HIV. And so when it comes to HIV, it touches my heart and it touches everyone's heart. A lot of people have opened up to talking about HIV and AIDS.
In his story, he takes on the persona of a young man who finds out he is HIV positive and feels desperate because of it, a common occurrence in his community.
And I've personally known people who have gone for tests, and the first thing they said was, kill myself. I took a different stand.
In Yasani's dramatic first-person story, the young man realizes, with the help of a friend, that he must accept the reality of his HIV-positive status, and that it's not a death sentence, especially if it's faced head-on. Halfway around the globe, in the state of Veracruz, Mexico, Gregoria Huesca produces radio with a youth group at a community organization called AUGE. The group won first prize for the UNICEF One World Radio Contest in the PSA category. Huesca believes training young people in the media is a way of creating future leaders.
What we try to do is to train them well, to inform them, so that when they are trained, they can reproduce what they learned with their companions, in their schools, in their communities, and among their families.
Norma Garcia, a 17-year-old girl, is part of the AUGE team who made the winning PSA.
We who live in Veracruz are suffering in the face of the crisis of a high rate of HIV infection in the state. And this is the place where we live, grow up, and develop as young people. And I believe that as young people, we should have a consciousness of what's happening, because we are one of the groups most vulnerable to infection.
The winning PSA that Norma helped create is called Lupita. In the piece, we hear children in a schoolyard deciding to exclude a young indigenous classmate who they have just learned has HIV.
This society discriminates. Perhaps we don't have the right information, or we don't know how to use it, because some of us believe that an infected person can infect us by just being nearby. So in this spot, we are trying to reflect this, how the average person is discriminating against infected people.
Itzel Navarro, 16, is another member of AUGE's youth radio group and also worked on Lupita. She says that when they made the PSA, they were trying to reach an audience of young people as well as adults.
This spot was created to inform our community about these important themes. What is AIDS, as well as others, like what is sexuality? Themes that interest young people. But also, maybe we can send a message to adults to say that youth are not only concerned with fun, but we're equally interested in serious matters, that we live in the world too.
Back in Zambia, Yasani Jose summarized the feelings he had about winning this contest. UNICEF and One World have put their first place awardees on a global platform, and each winner has received a new recording kit to continue their work and a gold medal plaque.
When we won the UNICEF thing, it really showed us that, you know, our works could be recognized not only in Africa, but in the world. And so UNICEF has really shown us that we stand a chance out there, and that if we keep on keeping on, anything is possible.
You can hear the winning entries of the 2006 UNICEF One World Radio Contest by Auhe in Veracruz, Mexico, and Yasani Jose in Lusaka, Zambia, at www.unicef.org. This is UNICEF Radio. I'm Blue Chevigny. Unite for Children.
This is Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. And we're back with Indie Media On Air. We're listening to the Deconstructing Dinner Show from Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia, offering two unique alternatives that can serve up a little less guilt in every coffee cup.
So now we have explored where the Capoline coffee beans originate, but where do they end up? Well, one place is located here in Nelson, British Columbia, and that is the Clean Bean Cafe, a newly established espresso stand that operates out of the back of a trailer. The coffee sold exclusively at the cafe is Capoline coffee. But the real interest of this next segment is the social and environmental change that this cafe is encouraging. And it has nothing to do with the beans themselves. The Clean Bean Cafe is located directly beside the main highway running through the city and is essentially a drive-through coffee shop. But here's the scoop. The Clean Bean Cafe does not provide any disposable takeout containers, no takeout cups. Certainly a new approach to takeout coffee service that I, for one, have never seen. And here's a segment featuring the Clean Bean Cafe's Benji Hansen. This probably has to be the closest interview that I've ever done to the radio station. We are literally one block away from the radio station here on the streets of Nelson. And I'm standing here beside what literally is a highway with Benji Hansen of the Clean Bean Cafe. And now that we've learned where the beans are coming from in Mexico, we're now here on the streets of Nelson learning where the beans end up in the mugs of people.
I first encountered Capoline in Tucson, Arizona, working at a vegetarian restaurant. The Oasis Vegetarian Eatery. I was a bartender there. Yeah, it was an alcohol-free bar, so one of the main drinks that I was able to serve up was espresso. We happen to serve exclusively Capoline beans. Daniel Four Winds was that man who happened to teach me the art of espresso, how to taste espresso. He turned me on to the character of Capoline, the origin of Capoline, and what makes it what it is.
One of your last customers came in and said that they come here for your energy. But you say that the energy isn't really coming from you, but it's coming through the coffee.
I guess the way I see it and the way I feel it is it's the energy of the earth being uninterrupted because this coffee is... The Arabica typica trees are growing in the rainforest, in the jungle. Those are happy trees. And they're putting out happy cherries, which got right in the middle of them, they got happy beans. And they got happy people touching these beans, working these beans by hand and with hand tools, from turning with shovels the cherries as they dry in the sun, to winnowing, hulling and winnowing the beans, and then hand processing these beans. That, to me, is the most beautiful thing, the most beautiful bean I've ever encountered. The fact that it is considered all the way from the earth to the separating table, to the cup. It's uninterrupted love, and I can't help but to be excited about it. I can't help but to love it.
Now, as Daniel so eloquently puts it, you know, this coffee is social change in a cup. But in your little hut here, right on the side of the highway, you have your own sort of level of social change that you're encouraging. And here we are standing as more or less a drive-through espresso shop, yet you don't offer any takeout containers.
Shoot, man, it's my conscience. I can't stand walking down the sidewalk seeing a paper cup that's been walked on, driven over on the street. It breaks my heart to know that that cup was once, it depends how you break it apart, but the ink, there's the petroleum products that have been used as a sealant, and there's also the meat of trees laying there on the street, and I can't stand for that, and I can't stand to see it even in a trash bin, let alone on the street. And there's no point. There's plenty of artisans making beautiful ceramic mugs, works of art, and even there's a good bit of vintage mugs out there too that are maybe looking for a home, sitting on the shelf at your local thrift shop.
Well, so you have this collection of mugs here, and you refer to your mugs as your children, and that here is a mug orphanage. And I notice when people come up to ask for a coffee, that you contemplate what kind of mug you want to give them. What's going through your head when you're deciding which mug is going to be the best mug for your customer?
Well, that's okay. There are a few mugs here in my orphanage, if you will. Have been handcrafted by local artisans, so number one, if they're going to stick around the trailer, I might give them one of those special mugs. If they're going to walk down the street, I'll maybe send them away with a more generic, say, mug. People are dropping off mugs all the time. I do appreciate the ones that have special markings. I have one with a Fozzie mug. Got the Muppet Show, and he's got his finger in his mouth. Yeah, just special mugs like that.
You mentioned that people walk away with their mugs, and I've been watching that, you know, people come up here, order a coffee, you put it in a mug, and then they walk away. I mean, this is something that no one ever sees anywhere. And I likened it the other day to going into the drive-thru at McDonald's, and instead of receiving your paper bag and your styrofoam containers, you instead receive reusable plates. And they trust that you're going to bring those plates back. And the idea of that's almost absurd for most people, that would never happen. But here, you're letting people walk away with mugs.
They're coming back. And if not, they must have found a good home. I trust that people won't just disregard a mug as something to be set and forgotten. Someone, somewhere, at some point in time, is going to consider that mug. Not just throw it into a trash bin. At least give it, like I say, to the local thrift shop. And, mugs have a life of their own. They're not easily tossed by the wayside, say.
If you have people coming up here who see this as a takeout drive-through espresso stand, what's the response from people when they recognize, well, there's no takeout cups? What kind of responses do you get?
I've had an assortment of responses. Everybody seems to respond in their own way, but definitely taken aback, seemingly on the verge of frustration, then realization that, oh, I like this idea. I don't have to throw something away. And most often, are more than pleased to take the ceramic mug. I've had probably three customers come and actually turn around and leave because I didn't have cups with lids. And it doesn't make me, I can still smile and give out ceramic mugs and not even stop to consider buying paper cups.
You use the word slowing down. Can you talk about this idea of how your coffee stand is allowing people to slow down?
No, it's a beautiful thing, you know, offering the ceramic mugs. Numerous times folks have pulled up on their way through, maybe not from town, or maybe from Castlegar, maybe, you know, going through on this highway, and they're anticipating picking up their coffee and hopping back in their car. They realize that there's only ceramic mugs. They do. They stop, and on the verge of being upset, they say, well, maybe I can sit down and enjoy this coffee. It's a beautiful thing. People get to stop and enjoy themselves in the middle of the day and also feel good about the fact that they aren't throwing a cup away just for convenience sake. It's a beautiful thing to be able to offer people that opportunity.
Taste a little of the summer, my grandma put it all in jar.
That was Deconstructing Dinner, where host John Steinman explored the persistent problems of coffee. The full show is available online. To get there, go to the KPFK website, click on Programs, then choose the Indie Media on Air. There you'll find a link to the full Deconstructing Dinner show. This is Indie Media on Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to The Upbeat Gardener. I'm Marian Owen. When the sun comes out, so do garden tools like lawnmowers and rototillers. As effective as they may be, mowers and tillers are getting the evil eye for their use of fossil fuel, as well as their contribution to air and water pollution. Lately, rototillers are on the hot seat. Contrary to what we've been told, rototilling does not improve the soil, it destroys it. What seemed like an efficient way to make short work of turning garden soil, tilling actually harms the structure of the soil and destroys aeration and drainage. When you look below the surface, soil is an intricate blend of rock particles, organic matter, roots, bacteria, worms, water, and air. In fact, 50% of soil is made up of water and air. These are important highways that deliver and store water and nutrients. Crank up the rototiller and you crush all these tunnels and pockets, as well as the worms and other critters that made them. After rototilling, the soil looks nice and fluffy, but it quickly loses structure, and it's all downhill from there. The soil compacts and loses its ability to hold water and nutrients, which means you have to water and fertilize more often. Plants become stressed and they become susceptible to diseases. Rototilling is also your worst enemy in the war against weeds. It exposes to light the seeds buried deep in the soil. All it takes is a nanosecond of exposure for weed seeds to sprout when they otherwise would have remained dormant. On a larger scale, deep tilling is to blame for the destruction of topsoil that once supported America's breadbasket in the Midwest. So how did we ever get the idea that tilling was a good thing? In the days of Thomas Jefferson, it was believed that plant roots actually ate soil particles. Therefore, the more you pulverized the soil, the easier it was for roots to eat it. So it seemed logical to till the earth. Today, electron microscopes show us how important a soil structure or tilth really is. So if you own a rototiller, consider selling it on eBay and use organic methods like mulching and composting instead. In other words, let the earthworms and other critters do more of the work for you. You'll be surprised at how easy gardening can be. Got comments? My email address is mygarden@alaska.net. See you next time. I'm Marian Owen.
What's your name?
Cristina Navoa.
And you were a victim of police violence today?
Yes, I was shot at, you know. I was just there making sure people were calm and not, you know, throwing things or, you know, overreacting. And the cops, you know, they provoked all this. They rushed all the way from the beginning of on 7th and Alvarado, and they just surged onto the park, you know, crossing Wilshire, people running across the street, jumping the fences, kids were running, children were crying. It was just a horrific sight after such a wonderful and calm and peaceful and family event. You know, the cops militarized this event. There was no need to bring the SWAT team and, you know, horses and stuff like that. It was just a huge disappointment of where my tax money goes to.
The immigrant rights marches on May 1st began as a celebration of so many of the things that make our nation strong. The immigrants who've built our infrastructure, who feed us and care for our children, and whose own children grow up to be great national leaders like Cesar Chavez. The opportunity the United States provides for people to flee oppression elsewhere, to come here and reinvent themselves, and to fight for greater freedoms. The right to speak out publicly and to freely assemble to express opinions that may be unpopular. In the end, the May 1st marches were all of those things. But they were also a reminder that we must continue to be vigilant to protect those rights, and just how far we have to go to ensure that the police protect the rights of all.
Okay, sorry about that. CPG copy, there is a slight crowd. It's on the both corners of, on the north side of 6th Street at Alvarado. They're not 415, they're code 4s at this time, but there's still a crowd here.
2.30, show me code 6, 6 in Alvarado with a squad of 8.
Airship, that northeast corner's been getting a little hostile. I've been getting some bottles and stuff thrown, but no officers have been hit.
Okay, Roger that here. High ground's still clear at this time, just except for those eye of balconies. Just a heads up on that.
What you're listening to right now is live audio from police scanners recorded during the May 1st march in MacArthur Park. You can hear a full half hour of that audio, plus interviews with people live on the scene of the march, on the website for the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. Both KPFK and LA Indie Media have covered the event, its aftermath, and the continuing fallout. As I've followed the coverage, I've come to realize there is a deeply disturbing assumption behind the development and use of these so-called less-than-lethal weapons. It's more fundamental than the problem we're all aware of, which is that less-than-lethal is a euphemism that doesn't always turn out to be true. Rubber bullets, tasers, and the rest can and do kill. And they have, from Palestine to Northern Ireland to the United States. What I find perhaps more disturbing is the apparent assumption behind the development and use of these types of weapons. That assumption is that we cannot control our own police forces. That when angry, under stress, and feeling threatened, the police will shoot. That they do not have the ability to take other action, even when facing a crowd of peaceful families. Because we believe we cannot control them, we've developed an arsenal of weapons made from wood, bean bags, and something the media keeps referring to as fiber, in hopes that when the police shoot, they won't kill. I respectfully disagree. I believe our police can be better controlled. They can be trained and punished and the problem elements fired until they learn to react without reaching for their weapons. I expect and demand nothing less. The police actions on May 1st were inexcusable. It's time for a new approach that is truly less than lethal. This is Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center, and this has been Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. On today's show, we learned about coffee alternatives that deliver up a little less guilt in every cup. It came to us courtesy of Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. We also heard organic gardener Marion Owen, the upbeat gardener, who gave us a whole new way of looking at tilling the soil. She gardens and produces her audio briefs in Kodiak, Alaska. And we heard a weekly roundup of media news from John Anderson and Kimberly Chronic of Media Minutes. To hear all these audio pieces in full and to find a link to the Los Angeles Indie Media website, visit kpfk.org. Click on Programs, then choose Indie Media On Air. If you'd like to comment on this show, please drop me a line at radioimc@gmail.com. Please join us again next week and every Monday at 3 p.m. for Indie Media On Air.